Every year in the United States, there are 15,000 murders, give or take a few hundred. Of those, nearly 40% go unsolved. My name is Christina Walsh, and you're listening to Forgotten. I hate unsolved mysteries. Not the show, capital U, capital M, Unsolved Mysteries. I love that show. I used to watch it all the time with my father, ironically. I loved the people in it, and the clues they followed, and their dogged determination to catch the bad guys. That's almost certainly why I'm doing a true crime audio series today, go figure. But my favorite part, every single time, was when the host would get on and say, "In a recent broadcast." Because then I knew that one of the mysteries had been solved. "In a recent broadcast, we talked about a woman named Jane Doe." I couldn't get the rights to rebroadcast actual audio from Unsolved Mysteries, so I just did that voice myself. That's what happens when you're recording from a dorm room. But my point is, I like solved mysteries. I like watching the questions unfold. But I want there to be answers at the end. I want to know who did it and how and why. I don't want ghost stories in the Cecil Hotel. I want a perpetrator and I want to understand them. And I want justice. But like I said in the intro, less than 2 out of 3 murder victims ever get justice. Way too often, the investigation stalls and the case goes nowhere and the victim gets forgotten. And I want to do something about that. The music I played in the intro was Violin Concerto No. 1 by a Polish composer named Karol Szymanowski. And while he's not as famous as maybe he should be, he's not exactly forgotten either. People perform his work all the time. But the odds are very good that you've never heard this recording by this violinist. Let me play a little more for you. That's Leona McPherson. And before she died in 1994, she was a violin prodigy. 22 years old, she played in some of the most prestigious venues in the world with some of the best orchestras and conductors. Ricardo Chailly in Bologna, Seiji Ozawa in Boston. Music is actually my specialty. I'm not a journalism major, despite what this crime investigation might suggest. I'm a music history major at NYU. So, not only can I assure you that this performance is incredibly good, I can also tell you that the fact that I've never heard it before is, if not exactly unbelievable, at the very least, strange. A violinist of this caliber from that era is absolutely the kind of thing that should have been on my radar. But Leona isn't really on anyone's radar. Here's my friend Gabriel Lopez, a DJ for a classical music radio station out of NYU.
Leona McPherson was a phenomenal talent, just phenomenal.
Phenomenal for her age?
for any age. I mean, concert soloists have a lot of prodigies already, right? You're always hearing about some 12-year-old genius out of Japan who can play circles around Itzhak Perlman or who blows people away with some jaw-dropping YouTube video playing at double speed with their eyes closed.
I love those videos.
I love the one you sent last week. That was crazy.
I know.
But anyway, there are amazing kids in the world making amazing music, but they don't always last. They burn out, or they're technically proficient but never get the spark of a real virtuoso. Most of them end up in orchestras or as run-of-the-mill soloists. Some of them become tutors and train the next child prodigy. But even some rando off the street who's never listened to classical music on purpose probably still knows about Itzhak Perlman or Yo-Yo Ma or more modern ones like Lindsey Stirling. She was on Dancing with the Stars, for crying out loud. But the point is, some people become household names and some don't. Leona McPherson, right, based on my research, was on track to be a household name. She predates Dancing with the Stars by a few decades, but she was a guest on Sesame Street. She played, wow, with the three tenors. She played with Yanni, which was kind of the Dancing with the Stars of 1993. Leona was on fire.
Wow. Gabriel is the one who introduced me to Leona McPherson's music. He stumbled onto her music last year, finding a dust-covered CD case in the back of the radio station's archive. There was a Post-it note on it that said, "One of my favorites," left by some past DJ. He put it on and was amazed and started sharing it with everybody. When he played it for me, it felt like finding a lost artifact, like someone had pulled an ancient statue from a shipwreck on the bottom of the sea, and I'm not the only one that feels that way. Here's Stephen Yates, a music professor at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. I spoke to him over the phone, so forgive the patchy sound.
I discovered Leona McPherson about 2 years ago, and honestly, at first, I thought I was being pranked. Nobody should be that famous and then that obscure that quickly.
Mr. Yates found mountains of evidence for Leona's rise to stardom. Playbills, CDs, television specials. But none of it was easy to find.
Honestly, it's embarrassing or infuriating. Take your pick. I've been at Curtis since the 70s, first as a student, then a coach, now a professor. How is it even possible that I had never heard of McPherson before? I was teaching here. I was teaching violin here when she was headlining the Chicago Symphony. Not just a chair or a featured guest. Headlining. Either I was derelict in my duties or someone was hiding her from me. That's why I prefer fury to embarrassment. It lets me be angry at somebody else when I really should be angry at myself.
If you don't mind my asking, is it maybe a gender issue? Not that I'm accusing you of anything, but the culture in general. Back in the 90s, women didn't get as much notoriety.
But Leona McPherson did. That's the part I don't understand. Mm. And you're right to ask, because even today, when more than half of an orchestra might be women, there are plenty of female musicians toiling in undeserved obscurity, waiting to be discovered. But McPherson was discovered. We had found her, and the world was better for it. And then we lost her again.
I don't think that Yates never heard about Leona. I think he forgot her. I think most people did. He discovered her again in a story very similar to Gabriel's. For Yates, it was an old recording of Béla Bartók's Violin Concerto No. 2, just lost in the back of his collection. And the thing is, he'd probably listened to that Bartók concerto dozens of times, and it just never caught him the way it did on that one perfect time. Music has a way of doing that. But with Leona McPherson, it was the whole world that forgot her, and almost instantly, after she was murdered.
Okay, I think I found it.
The police report?
Yeah, well, now, here's another one. I have two reports under that name. You said Leona McPherson.
Yes.
Can you give me the date again?
That's Tracy Clark, an archivist for the Los Angeles Police Department. I called her to request the files for Leona's case, the missing persons report, the day she was found, and so on. And this is where Leona's story goes from forgotten prodigy to a true unsolved mystery.
I have a missing persons report for a Leona McPherson dated March 18th, 1994, and another one dated March 19th of the same year. Here's another one for March 22nd, and here's another one for March 18th again. Was the first one 18? Yes, March 18.
You see, the LAPD had four separate missing persons reports for Leona. Two filed by her mother/manager, Catherine. One by the events coordinator at the Hollywood Bowl, where she was supposed to have a performance. And one by the Roosevelt Hotel, where she was staying. Three of them were taken by the same officer, a detective named Jimmy Ortiz, and the other, which was actually the second chronologically, was taken by Detective Derek Malone. It should not come as a surprise to you that this is not normal. Four missing persons reports for the same person, all written within a week of each other? The first report should have been the only one. Every other report that was made should have referenced back to that main one and simply expanded the case instead of starting a new one. But we got this mess instead. And there are a lot of things that might have happened, and there are a lot of things that definitely didn't happen, and there are a lot of things that I haven't been able to find yet. But let me just lay my thesis statement right here on the line. I think her mother killed her and the cops covered it up. It's the only explanation that makes sense. I can't prove it yet. But let's take a look at the evidence. First, I had some more questions for Tracy Clark. Miss Clark, is this kind of thing common? Four reports for a single missing persons incident?
No, ma'am. All I can think is that maybe they lost them and had to keep redoing them.
From different people?
I don't know what to tell you. I'm reading them now and they don't even reference each other. I thought maybe they were progress reports misfiled as missing persons reports, but no, these are all initial contact.
What does that mean?
An initial contact report is the first report taken by an officer when someone reports a crime. We write down the information, get all the contact info, that sort of thing, and create a file. And then we use that file to track the case while it's being investigated. That's why I thought the reports might have been lost, because each one is just initial contact, no follow-up. No extra notes, just filed and then never touched again.
What about the fourth report? The one from the 22nd? That's the last one?
Yes, ma'am.
Does that one have any follow-up?
No, ma'am.
So, that's the first problem. Four completely unconnected police reports, all for the same crime, many of them by the same people. I don't have a lot of experience with police reports. I'm a music major, remember? But I've at least watched enough episodes of Brooklyn Nine-Nine to know that this is incredibly sloppy at best. More likely, it's a sign that the case was being purposefully buried. And before we get too deep into it, I think it's a good idea to look at that case in as broad, general terms as possible. Here are the details as best as I've been able to piece them together. On March 17th, 1994, Leona and Catherine McPherson arrived in Los Angeles for a concert in the Hollywood Bowl. They went to the Roosevelt Hotel and checked into two separate rooms, 410 and 411. The next morning, Catherine knocked on Leona's door and got no answer. She called her room. No answer. After a few hours, she got worried and asked the concierge to open the door and see if something had happened. The room had all of Leona's luggage, but no Leona. I know all of this because it was in the first police report, the one Catherine filed on March 18th. None of the other reports mention any of it. Catherine spent her day talking to the police until sometime in the late afternoon when she returned to her room and essentially disappeared from the record of the day. I don't know where she was or what she was doing until the following day around noon, but we'll get to that in a minute. First, a few hours later, on the evening of the 18th, Hollywood Bowl events coordinator Franklin Steinberg realized that his star violinist hadn't shown up yet and called the hotel, only to learn that the person at the desk had never even heard of Leona McPherson. That's another red flag. Detective Ortiz had been in the hotel all morning, allegedly talking about Leona to everyone he could find. But all of a sudden, this clerk had never heard of her. We don't know who answered the phone. Maybe it was someone new who'd just started their shift. But even then, I would have expected some gossip. It seems more likely to me that Ortiz simply didn't actually ask anyone about anything, which would explain why the guy at the desk didn't know anything. But I admit that this is pure conjecture on my part. I have no evidence to back it up, but it's pretty friggin' suspicious. Anyway, moving on. Whatever the reason behind the desk clerk's ignorance, it was enough to convince Steinberg that his star violinist had gone missing. And he got so worried that he called the police and filed a missing persons report of his own. Detective Malone took this one and, just like the one from Ortiz, it was dutifully recorded and filed, and then never followed up on ever again. Steinberg has, like so many other people involved in this case, refused to talk to me, so all I know is what's in the report. Well, actually, I do know a little more about the concert. The LA Times ran a review of the concert in the next morning's paper, calling it a delight even without the intriguing guest soloist. Apparently, the orchestra conductor announced that Leona had been unable to make it, and an understudy named Ben Holmes played in her place. The review closes with a final brief mention of Leona, and I quote, "It's too bad about this McPherson. Her bio in the playbill was so effusive, I can't help but hope to see her on stage sometime." The same reviewer had covered her three tenors appearance only a year earlier, but didn't seem to put two and two together. The next morning, March 19th, Catherine woke up, packed her bags, and wandered downstairs to check out of the hotel. The desk clerk, of course, charged her for both rooms, 410 and 411, but she contested the charge. She told them, and then later that day she told the police, that she had no memory of a second room or of traveling with a daughter. And there's your, is this the fourth now? Your fourth red flag. Catherine flew here with her daughter, checked in with her daughter, filed a police report about her daughter, and then tried to convince people she didn't remember having a daughter at all. That's the guiltiest thing I've ever heard. She was either lying or on drugs or both. It was not until the desk clerk took her up to room 411 that Catherine saw the luggage and quote-unquote remembered Leona. She broke down in tears, called the police, and filed the third missing persons report in 2 days. And Here's your fifth red flag. That report was taken by Detective Jimmy Ortiz, the same guy who'd talked to her the day before, and he doesn't mention this in his notes. He posits that Catherine might be delusional or high, but he makes no reference whatsoever to the fact that he was already supposed to be investigating this exact disappearance. He just writes it all down, takes it to the station, files the new report, and then, red flag number six, never follows up on it. Ever again. You can see why I'm so suspicious of these people. The deception seems so glaringly obvious, so much so that it's hard for me to believe that nobody else ever noticed it. With Catherine, I can almost convince myself she was so distraught over the disappearance that she went out and got drunk and then just was a huge stumbling mess the next day. I can almost believe that. But the cops? To take these reports, put on a facade of helpful competence, and then bury them for 25 years? Ortiz is either covering something up or he's incredibly bad at his job. And spoiler warning, I've got a whole bit coming up later in the episode that proves he was very, very good at his job. So I'm sticking to my cover-up theory. But in a larger sense, do you see now why this case is so fascinating to me? When I first heard Leona's CD, when I heard her play, I felt something transcendent, something transporting. Leona was a singular talent who seemed to reach out across space and time and grip me by the heart. And then start researching her, only to find out that she had been murdered and that her case had been riddled with holes. It feels like a Raymond Chandler novel. That bright young ingenue, the shady hotel clerk, the corrupt cops, and the mother swinging wildly between tears and delusion. It seems so obvious, more than 25 years later, that this was an inside job, somehow. That the mother or the police or both were somehow in on this murder together. Throw in the glamour of the classical music and the riches of a globe-trotting superstar, and you've got a film noir fit for Humphrey Bogart. This should have been the biggest story of the year. But instead, it was nothing. Leona was gone, and nobody even looked for her. Here's Tracy Clark again.
The fourth missing persons report was filed by the Roosevelt Hotel on March 23rd. It says they tried to assign room 411 to somebody, but they couldn't find the key, so they sent the housekeeping staff upstairs to check it out. They said it was full of a woman's luggage.
Leona's room?
Room 411. That was the same one, right? Yes, ma'am. 411. They didn't think anyone was in there, so they looked through the luggage and found a driver's license for Leona McPherson. This is weird as hell.
Tracy Clark was a delight to talk to, and we've got a lot more from her, so don't worry.
So the hotel called the precinct and reported a missing woman. They talked to Ortiz again, and he came over and took their statements and filed a report. Again. Took some evidence, too, it looks like.
The luggage?
That's what it says. There's a tracking number here. I'll see if I can find out what happened to it.
Okay. This is now Detective Ortiz's third trip to the same hotel to talk about the same missing woman. And not once does he mention this in any of the reports. And just like the other three reports, this fourth one went nowhere. It was filed, and it was never followed up. Which is astonishing, because the very next day, they found her body.
In other news, a woman's body was found in the Colonia neighborhood of Los Angeles today, an area now full of abandoned and condemned homes in the wake of the devastating January earthquake. According to police, four local children were looking for copper and other things to sell when they stumbled upon a corpse. Information is scarce, and the authorities are choosing to keep many of the details confidential to help protect their investigation. They urge all citizens in the area to stay calm.
They didn't know yet that this was Leona. She had no ID on her or near her. And no one on the force recognized her, not from any of the reports, because apparently nobody looked at them, and not even from the concert posters at the Hollywood Bowl. The officer in charge of the investigation was a man named Blake Hensley. Here's Tracy Clark reading Hensley's incident report about the body.
On March 24th, 1994, four youths waved down a patrol car in the neighborhood of Colonia, near the corner of 73rd and Paloma. The officer said they looked scared and they told him about a dead body. The children's names and contact information are attached. Let me see here. Yeah, here it is. Do you need those too?
Every lead helps, I guess.
Yeah, that's how I know you're new at this.
Tracy was right, of course. Those leads went nowhere. I talked to all four children, all of whom are older than I am at this point, but other than a vague memory of dealing with the police, none of them recalled anything specific about this day or this body. And yes, that seems weird, since you'd think you'd remember something as traumatic as a dead body. But it was 25 years ago, and maybe they tried to block out the memories or something. Either way, there's no evidence that the kids had anything to do with Leona other than finding her. So we'll keep their names out of it and let them live their lives. Anyway, back to the report.
Okay, the officer called dispatch and the youth led him to 734 Calibri Street. I joined him there soon after. The home had been condemned in January and the windows boarded over. But someone had pried open a back door and appeared to have been living in the home for several weeks. There were blankets and empty bottles, and the bathtub had been converted to a fire pit. One of the bedrooms was full of animal bones and appeared to have been used as a slaughterhouse.
I'm sorry. I didn't know. Is that how she died?
Yeah, it's fine. I have worked in this precinct for 10 years, and I've heard about a lot of messed up stuff. But, slaughtered by a cannibal is pretty out there.
I'm sorry. I didn't know. That's the thing about Leona. Nobody knows anything about her. Oh, I had no idea she was eaten.
Okay, hold on. I don't think she was.
Okay.
I wasn't reading ahead. It just, you know, caught my eye.
Okay.
You know, in the next paragraph, it says she was fully clothed, so I'm pretty sure they didn't need her if she was fully clothed.
Okay.
Anyway, there's the part about the slaughterhouse, and then it says the body was in the front living room, fully clothed, laying on her back with her arms and legs spread out. It appeared that she had been placed there after death, as the majority of the blood was outside the front door.
Oh, God.
She had a puncture in her chest, but the stab wound probably came through the back. Forensics was called to find out for sure.
Mm-hmm.
The victim's right eye had been removed. Are you sure you want to hear more of this?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. You're not one of those people who obsess over serial killers, are you? Do you get off on this kind of stuff?
No. I promise. I'm not. I'm a student at NYU, like I told you, working on a class project.
Good. Forensics.
Music history.
What?
I'm a music history major at NYU with an emphasis on symphonic orchestra and a minor in trumpet, but...
Trumpet?
I played trumpet in marching band in high school.
Why on God's green earth is a trumpet player calling me up on the opposite side of the continent to ask about some serial killer slaughtering animals and stealing little girls' eyeballs?
And this, dear listeners, is where we go off topic a bit. I was hoping I could do this investigation and find some answers and talk about Leona the whole time, but I guess we're going to talk about me now. Not the whole time, and honestly, I wasn't planning to talk about me at all, but Tracy asked, and I answered because I was trying to keep her on the phone long enough to get all the info I needed, and my phone was already recording, and Gabe heard that recording when I was trying to put this episode together, and he thought it was important. Well, he said it was good, actually, and I don't know how good it is, and I definitely don't want to make this whole thing about me, but I think he has a point. If nothing else, it's important for you to know why I'm doing this show. So, here goes. My dad disappeared 2 years ago. We were never super close, but, well, that's not true. He was my dad, you know? I loved him. And I know he loved me, but he was never exactly warm, I guess is the word. He did his best. He wasn't thrilled about me moving out to NYU and leaving him alone, but what else was I going to do? Stay home forever? He didn't want to be alone, and I know that. And I didn't want to be alone either. Nobody does. But I also didn't want to stagnate. I didn't want to stay home and be nothing forever. And I knew that I'd rather be alone than be nothing. So I applied to college and I got in and I moved to New York and I made new friends. And I called him every Sunday. Most Sundays. Okay, like a lot of Sundays. And one day, I called home, and he didn't answer. And a few days later, I got a call from the police asking if I knew where he was. I'd missed a few Sundays at that point, so I hadn't talked to him in 3 weeks. 3 weeks. He'd been missing for two by the time the cops called me. Like, what kind of horrible daughter doesn't know that her father has been missing for two whole weeks? You know who reported him missing? It was the paper boy. I didn't even know they still had paper boys, but my dad got the paper, the physical, printed newspaper every day. Like, the caveman used to get, and after 2 weeks of papers piled up on his porch, the paper boy got worried and rang his doorbell. Not his neighbors, not his friends, not even his worthless, wayward daughter on the other side of the country. His paper boy.
Where's your mom?
She died. But like... when I was a kid, 2010.
Cancer?
Foreign correspondent. Somalian Civil War.
Damn. Again.
So, he's why I'm doing this, and she's why I'm recording it. Does that make any sense?
She used to send me recordings of herself instead of doing phone calls because the time zones were way off and it was easier. So I'd listen to her voice, and I'd listen to her on the TV or on the radio talking about horrible things that were happening. And I guess some part of me thought that this was the way to process tragedy, by recording it. And then he disappeared, and I've spent 2 years trying to find him. And I don't know. I shouldn't be just vomiting my emotions all over you.
No. It's fine. It's fine. That's a lot to go through.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's okay.
Tracy is great. I said that earlier. I suppose it's working in a police station that gives her such an incredible ability to keep her cool no matter the situation. One second, she was standing up for herself, and the next, she was caring for me. And I have to assume that a real journalist wouldn't go all teary monologue on someone she was interviewing for a case. I know my mom never would. But that's what you get from the trumpet player, I guess. Tracy and I talked for a while. And honestly, it was mostly just about me and my dad. So, rather than play that whole thing or try to cut it down into something more digestible, I'll just summarize it like this. I spent 2 years trying to find my dad. And the only thing I learned was that people disappear all the time, and way too many of them never get found. My dad never did. We're pretty sure he didn't go into hiding because all of his stuff was still there. He didn't take his car. He didn't pack his bag. His wallet was with him, we assume, so that's gone, but the bank account is untouched. The credit cards haven't been used. He's just gone. Just evaporated off the face of the earth. This was in LA, where I grew up, and where he still lived. And after a year, the state court officially declared him dead. And after another 6 months, my therapist convinced me to go back to college. So here I am, trying to study music history and pay attention in an endless stream of solo instrumental performances, and all I can think about is a man that nobody around me ever even knew. The insurance company sent me a check, and then the whole world just forgot him. Just overnight. I bet even the paperboy doesn't think about him anymore, and honestly, that's probably a good thing because he was 12 years old and I don't want his childhood defined by that one time he reported a dead guy. I want him to forget it, just like those kids who found Leona. But I want to remember. I want to remember everybody I can. The world moves on, but I am determined that somebody somewhere is going to remember these people. So then I heard about Leona, and well, here we are, hip deep in my true crime therapy investigation combo. And because it's what my mom would have done, I'm trying to solve the mystery. So, let's get back to it. Tracy eventually just faxed me copies of the police reports. Their best guess is that her captor tortured her, freed her, and then shot her in the back while she was running. Then he brought her back inside,
carefully arranged her on the floor and removed her eye. Then he left. And investigators are fairly certain nobody entered the home again until those four kids wandered in and found her. And don't worry, I checked. It looks like the kids never saw the slaughterhouse in the back bedroom, so that's one tiny, bright spot of light in this dismal parade of horrors. And how do I know this? Because I was finally able to talk to one of the people involved in the case.
My name is Blake Hensley. I was a detective with the LAPD for about 26 years, and a beat cop for a couple of decades before that. I retired in 2015.
Most of the people I called for this story refused to talk to me, or I just had wrong numbers. I'm still working on those, and maybe we'll get something in a future episode. But Detective Hensley agreed to talk after I sent him a copy of the police reports. Scanned and emailed, obviously, because seriously, who has a fax machine?
I admit that I did not remember this case at all until you sent me those files.
How do you forget a slaughterhouse, a bow and arrow murder, and a missing eyeball stolen from a world-renowned violinist?
If you knew half the stuff I saw on the force, you'd know this doesn't even crack the top 10.
Right. City of Angels.
Tell me about it. But now that I'm reading this report, it's coming back to me. You see, the first thing that tipped me off was the garbage.
Tipped you off?
Well, that it was strange. We get squatters all the time down here, you know, especially in 94 when the earthquake ruined all those houses. People moved out and the vagrants moved in. We'd go down every couple of weeks and roust them out, and oh, it was disgusting. Empty cans, broken bottles, fast food wrappers. They'd keep them in cans most of the time. They're not animals, you know. They're just people down on their luck. Some were worse than others, especially the junkies. They didn't care where they threw their garbage. But the regular ones, the families and stuff, they kept the houses clean.
And this guy? Was he clean or not clean? I'm not following you.
Well, that's because I'm thinking out loud. Sorry. It's not that he was any cleaner or messier than the other squatters we saw back then. It's that his garbage was different. Some glass bottles, sure, but no empty cans, no food wrappers, nothing you'd find in a grocery store, let's say. The guy was catching animals, stray dogs and alley cats and probably coyotes. The typical stuff we get in L.A., and then carefully skinning it, butchering it, and cooking it. The report says that the bathtub was a fire pit, but I'm telling you, it was like a full-on roasting station with a spit and everything. The kind you see at a Wild West show or like a Renaissance fair where they cook the food like in olden times.
Are you sure it was just alley cats and dogs?
Oh, there weren't any human bones. We checked, believe me.
Okay. So Leona was killed by a Ren Faire enthusiast? I guess that explains the bow and arrow.
We don't know who killed her. The investigation stalled because there was no way to track the guy down. Mm. DNA was brand new back then, or I guess DNA evidence was new. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They used it a bit for O.J. Simpson and for the Menendez brothers.
Right.
But it was shaky every time, and the juries didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we just didn't have the tools they've got now to turn that evidence into actionable intel. Maybe if they went back and opened the evidence, a modern lab could do something. But in 94, all we could do was collect it and ask around and hope he did it again, frankly. That sounds terrible, but That's how a lot of police work is. You can't see patterns until something repeats. And this guy never repeated. So we never caught him.